this service, in spite of the fact that Alex isn't taking it, is being recorded. I shall not listen to it again, because I can't stand hearing my own voice. But Alex has said that she'd like to extend a special welcome to those who are listening to the sermon at home. And that is part of the mission, isn't it, of our church? And when this has been uploaded, you will hear that there have been the Bible passages. And just so that these people who are at home has got them, Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 to 4, and Matthew chapter 4, verses 12 to 23. So you might just want to pause the recording at this point and read these passages, if you're clever enough to pause the recording. The people who have walked in darkness have seen a great light. When she was training for the ministry, Alex spent one June in Shetland. If you think about that a minute, Shetland is right up there, and the light goes on and on and on. And the light dims, but it's still possible to read a book in the small hours. Something magical about being able to see at night. Anne and I have experienced it when we've been in Norway and being taken up a very, very narrow fjord and the boat edging round. If you happen to see Lorraine Kelly this week, she was on the same similar boat, going in and coming within touching distance almost of the rocks. Very clever manoeuvre. But there's an air of possibility over things like that, and a feeling of being ever so slightly unhinged, because your sleep isn't the same. Unless you've got blackout blinds, some people find it very difficult to sleep. Alex didn't meet many people who did screen out the light, because the nights of sunlight were so special, and in contrast to the days of winter when they were so dark and there was very little sunlight, she wanted to make up for it. Light, of course, is best appreciated when it is dark. That relief of turning on a light. How often do we get to the back door, having been out for the evening, come back at times at this time of year, and, oh, we didn't leave the outside light on. So trying to get the key in the right place. We've all been through it. The relief of turning on a lamp, and we equate light with warmth and safety. I suppose it's in our DNA from when we were fire watchers in ancient times. It's in our cultural DNA too. And now it says a home without a fireplace feels not quite right. We haven't had a proper fireplace for ages, but still. Then we have the Olympic Games, and they can't begin until the official Olympic cauldron is lit by a flame which is being carried alight all the way from Olympia in Greece to the host city. The Olympic flame links our past and our future in the present moment. But if that flame gets out of control, then you can have a problem. When I was very young, before the time that Anne and I got together, so it must have been a long time ago, I went cycling with a friend of mine, And we went from Nottingham to Hope in Derbyshire, very near Castleton and the caves that are there. And it poured with rain and it was very dark. And we got into the tent and we put the paraffin stove down and we lit it. And it leaked. And it leaked onto the cover we put on the ground. And before we knew where we were, the whole of one side of the tent had gone. And we grabbed and just rolled over in it. It was very wet, that grass. I remember it now, I can feel it. But it was so careful that we had to be, and we hadn't been as careful as we should have been. Matthew looks backwards and projects forwards in his words, "The people living in darkness have seen a great light." And he's referring back to the words spoken by the prophet Isaiah, which you heard from Chris. And he ties those words into the beginning of Jesus' ministry. The light has come, not just any light, but a great light. So you might expect this great light to be found in the temple at Jerusalem or a Roman palace, somewhere expansive, expensive, somewhere regal. But no, this great light shines in a fishing village on the edge of the Roman Empire. And Matthew tells us that Jesus, upon hearing of John the Baptist's arrest, withdraws to Galilee, to the region of Zebulun and Naphtali, a place historically marked by oppression and obscurity. We're told that there had been disturbances there. And from the beginning, Jesus' ministry is rooted not in power or prestige, but in places that hurt. People who are overlooked. And it's there on the shore that he calls his first disciples. He sees Simon and Andrew casting their nets and he says, "Follow me and I'll make you fishers of men." He sees James and John mending their nets and he calls them too. And all four leave their nets immediately and follow. No prerequisites, just a call and a response. Excuse me. A great friend, college friend of mine, who we were training to teach, and he became best man, and eventually he went into the ministry. I taught with him in one school, and he rang me on one evening and said, "I'm going to see if they will accept me as a candidate for the ministry." And I said, "Oh, I was thinking of that." And he said to me, "I think you'll be better where you are, doing what you're doing it in the way that you do it, and you'll be able to help others." Good advice. But I rang my father. He was a minister, as many of you know, and he was living away from where we were, and I rang him and he said, "Oh, quiet." He was a man of very few words, but when he said something, you listened. Not a bit like me. He said to me, only go in if you can't stay out. And stay out I did. And looking back, it was very sound advice that I got from Graham and from my father. And for those of us navigating discipleship in a complex modern world, this passage reminds us of some core truths. I don't suppose that in a congregation such as this, we will find calls to totally new things. But small things are so important as well. And discipleship begins where you are now. Jesus doesn't wait for the disciples to become theologians or moral heroes. He meets them at work in the midst of their ordinary lives. The invitation to follow isn't about having it all together. It's about willing to walk a new path. It's not about knowing that we're right or that we have all the answers, but it's about knowing that Jesus wants to follow him. And it seems from the biblical account that we have in Matthew that they didn't even go and tell their fathers. And they went. I can imagine my relationships and my father breaking down somewhat if I hadn't told him what I was thinking about at that time all those years ago. Secondly, the call to discipleship is communal. Jesus doesn't just call individuals, he forms a community. Discipleship is not a solo journey, it's something we go do together. And this morning in the prayer, Jocelyn reminded me of the fact that so many people had come in and helped. Brian is going to do the intercessory prayers later. We've had Simon and Chris had to step into Sue's shoes because she's not well, and it's gone on like that, and all the people that help. And when I came in at 10 o'clock this morning, the place was humming. And that's excellent. So remember, the call to discipleship is communal. Something we do together, learning, stumbling, supporting, forgiving, growing. Thirdly, the call to discipleship will change your priorities. The disciples leave their nets, not necessarily because fishing is bad, but because something deeper is pulling them forward. The life of faith is often means losing our grip on what is familiar in order to make space for what is liberating. And sometimes we lose our grip because of circumstances and the way in which people come together and help others in need is a tremendous thing. And that is what the great light reveals. It reveals discipleship. Discipleship that begins where you are, that is communal, and that changes your priorities. And notice, Jesus doesn't say that the journey will, what the journey will look like. He doesn't promise comfort or clarity. What he offers is relationship. Follow me. Warren Carter, in his book Working Preacher, summarizes this call to discipleship beautifully, says Alex. Jesus then calls two sets of brothers to be his followers from Matthew chapter 4. They are fishermen embedded in the imperial economy. Rome asserted control over the land and sea. Their production and the transportation and marketing of their yields with contracts and taxes. And Jesus disrupts these men's lives, calls them to a different loyalty and way of life, creates a new community, and gives them a new mission: fish for people. His summons exhibits God's empire at work. This light shining in the darkness of Roman-ruled Galilee. For Christians who value inclusion, justice, and spiritual curiosity, this passage challenges us to consider, where am I being called to drop my nets? Little things that we've done, and we've fallen into doing them always. And if we don't do them, oh dear, something's not right. Sometimes we're called to leave those things and do others. What comfortable patterns or roles might I be asked to leave behind? How is it that Jesus is still calling me towards deeper healing, justice, and love? Discipleship at its core is not about certainty, it's about courage. It's about hearing the call and stepping out anyway, trusting that the light we've seen is worth following.